thanks very much for having me, here again. I also was part of the opening first speaking event last year, and I'm told that was the most successful year for the UVA Federalist Society. I'm happy to take credit for that, but if it doesn't work out, then clearly there's no correlation after all. This event, this topic, more than many, I think, can tease out something that is a key theme that Cato pushes, that the Federalist Society pushes, and that is the difference between law and policy. Those of you who have read my work or have read Cato's work know that my position on SB 1070 specifically, and in a lot of state regulations that touch on immigration, is that it's constitutional mostly, but bad policy. Those are two very different judgments that we need to make. You could have things that are vice versa, that are good policy but unconstitutional. It's very important. And indeed, it's often the test of whether someone is having academic or intellectual integrity, whether they can point to something that they think is good policy that they advance that, alas, would require a constitutional amendment, or something that, vice versa. So that's a theme that I want you to bear in mind. SB 1070 has been in place for over a year now, as of the end of July of last year. It's divided into 13 provisions, but however you slice it, only four parts of it were enjoined and remain enjoined based on the Ninth Circuit's affirmance, which is now, as Laura said, up on cert petition to see whether the Supreme Court will take it. The court ruled against the government on provisions criminalizing the transportation and harboring of illegal aliens and permitting the impoundment of vehicles used to transport or harbor them. And it left untouched about 10 provisions that the government did not challenge at all. I mean, the government said, well, strike the whole thing down. The judge said, well, we don't work that way. We have to look at provision by provision. So there's a whole slew of things, amending the crime of knowing employment of unauthorized aliens, requiring state officials work with federal officials with regard to unlawfully present aliens. There's a whole list of things that remains in place and is good law in Arizona that is not at issue. There are only four provisions here that are at issue. And by the way, based on these rulings and based on the frustrations that states continue to have with the federal government's continued bipartisan failure to do anything in this pressing area of policy, to have copycat and similar types of laws. Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Indiana, Utah, I think to name five states, have passed laws that are similar to the most controversial provisions in SB 1070. And some, I think 17 or more states have passed other laws relating to employment verification, the types of issues that were litigated and resolved by the Supreme Court this past term in a case called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting, which is related and relevant to the SB 1070 case, Arizona versus United States, but not completely determinative. In Whiting, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 ruling, said that the Arizona state law requiring the use of E-Verify, this electronic verification system that someone is legally authorized to work here, certain punishments, revocation of a business license for businesses that employ illegal aliens, that those were constitutional under the particular savings clause of IRCA, the governing statute relating to the regulation of immigration-related employment status. Again, the court has made clear in preemption challenges generally, not just immigration, but they are very case-by-case, provision-by-provision. You actually have to read the text of this. You don't just kind of argue rhetoric. Well, yes, supremacy clause, or yes, states' rights. And you have odd bedfellow coalitions. Some of these preemption cases are decided 9-0 one way or another. Some of them are decided 5-4. Some are somewhere in the middle, and you have different justices joining each other. This is not a kind of culture war touchstone type of, you know, is this a fundamental right? Is this whatever? These are really, you know, I caution you, you have to look at text by text, clause by clause, provision by provision to see whether there's conflict preemption, direct preemption of the state law by the federal law, or implied or field preemption, meaning that Congress has occupied that entire field, and even though there's nothing on point, the states can't legislate in that area. So, what are these four provisions that are at issue? So, first of all, Section 2B, if you're keeping track at home. Law enforcement officers have to determine the immigration status of all the individuals arrested in Arizona. So again, those that are lawfully detained for some reason, be it arrested or stopped, you know, traffic stop, whatever, and then if the law enforcement official has a reasonable suspicion that that person is in the country illegally, they have to perform a check, you know, report to the relevant, the applicable federal official. These aren't state officials making these checks of immigration status, but has to report to the federal official to say yay or nay, is the person in the country legally. Judge Bolton, the district court judge, as affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, held that this section would require police to determine the immigration status of everyone arrested in Arizona, not just those reasonably suspected of being illegal, that it effectively infringes on the federal responsibility to deal with immigration, with people who are here illegally, to control immigration databases, and more fundamentally, on federal enforcement decisions. You know, the federal government has limited number of resources, and they have discretion over how to enforce certain types of laws. You know, do we go after just those illegals that have committed violent crimes? Do we go after everyone? Do we, you know, try to make sure that all states try to pass these kinds of laws and cooperate more and more their local and state law enforcement with federal law enforcement, or just leave it to the feds and, you know, don't it's too messy or what have you with the states? I posit, is preemption by executive whim. You know, first of all, you know, if in some particular case the law enforcement official engages in racial profiling or otherwise, you know, acts without reasonable suspicion or detains somebody with a probable cause, you know, that's established Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, and we have laws to deal with that. And moreover, you can have an as-applied challenge. You know, none of these challenges that have been brought by the government. Now, the ACLU and La Raza and groups like this have brought challenges based on racial profiling that haven't gone anywhere. But the government's challenges, the preemption challenges, are based purely on federal versus state powers. And to the extent a facial challenge like that is involved, again, this is, you could have all of a sudden a change of policy going into the election year, or a change of administration. All of a sudden, the enforcement policies are different, or the resources are different, or what have you. And now the federal government likes what the states are doing, and therefore this provision all of a sudden becomes constitutional and is not preempted. That, I suggest, is not the way that we do preemption analysis. Preemption is about conflict of laws. Does the state law, by virtue of the Supremacy Clause, no state law can trump a federal law. So is this state law indeed infringing on a federal prerogative, legal prerogative, either directly or impliedly? As Judge Bea points out in dissent, it's very curious, a Hispanic immigrant dissented in the Ninth Circuit opinion. He points out, it cannot be the case that the legality of a state law turns on a given set of enforcement policies or practices as opposed to the text of the allegedly preemptive federal law itself. Okay, moving to Section 3. This makes it a state crime to violate federal alien registration laws. So unlike the case most at point, Hines v. Davidowitz, which is a case from the 40s, where the Supreme Court struck down a Pennsylvania law that imposed new types of registration requirements in that state. The court said, well, this federal registration is a supplemental to the federal law. It's something new, something different, and that that does indeed invade and is therefore preempted by federal law regarding control of immigration, registration requirements, and so forth. As distinct from that particular law, however, The law here does not add any additional registration requirements. Indeed, you don't even have to register your federal registration with the state or anything like that. That would violate the applicable conflict preemption standards under Hines v. Davidovitz. They just mirror federal law. So this, however the court rules, I mean, the law, there's no set Supreme Court precedent on this, but if they take the case and they rule on it, that'll be an important decision in what academics call mirror image theory. You know, can or concurrent enforcement of state and federal law. You know, if something is legitimately the under a federal purvey, can states simply mirror that without adding anything else and allow it to happen? Now, Judge Bea narrowly agreed with the majority in saying that this is preempted, but he took issue with part of the Ninth Circuit, the majority's rationale, effectively saying that a lot of foreign governments have complained about this, and he says, well, foreign governments don't get a heckler's veto on our laws, you know, regardless of whether they're okay or not under our own constitutional system. Again, I disagree with this because I don't think that Arizona adds any sort of supplemental requirements. They're, again, mirroring the federal law here. Next section, section 5C1. Makes it illegal for aliens to apply for work, solicit work in public places, or work as independent contractors. Here, I think probably the courts have gotten it right in striking this provision down, because IRCA, this is the Immigration Reform and Control Act, I believe is what it stands for, from 1996, put in a comprehensive regulatory scheme of employer sanctions. This was what was at issue at Whiting, one of these safe harbors for licensing regulations and things like this. And they considered having sanctions on employees or those seeking work, not just on employers, and rejected them. So I think there's strong evidence that Congress occupied the field here, and at least the way that Arizona's law is drawn, this provision, I think, is correct to strike it down. But it's a close case. There are good arguments that Paul Clement in his cert petition and the state below makes. And finally, Section 6, which permits warrantless arrests where the local law enforcement officer has probable cause to believe that, quote, the person to be arrested has committed any public offense that makes the person removable from the United States. Now, the court essentially is saying here that, well, so are we to expect local law enforcement officials to know what deportable offenses are when we get a regular diet of these complicated cases at the Supreme Court? I submit that that is for facial challenges, for as-applied challenges. And facially, this should survive for the reasons that Judge Bea articulated in his dissent again. I'll just finish by laying out, which maybe I should have started with, the standard for preemption in the immigration context. And I know I'm going a minute over. Maybe I'll speak less in rebuttal, or Professor Martin can take an extra minute on his opening remarks. A state regulation is only preempted, one, if it falls into the narrow category of, quote, a regulation of immigration, two, if Congress expressed, quote, the clear and manifest purpose of completely occupying the field and displacing state activity, and three, if the state regulation conflicts with federal laws such that it, quote, stands as an obstacle to the accomplishment and execution of the full purposes and objectives of Congress. That's the DeCanis case. Otherwise, a state or local government, the court said in that case, is free to enact a law that discourages illegal immigration or deals with aliens without being preempted. And if you want to talk about policy, where we might have more agreement between us, we can do that in the Q&A, because I think that, again, I gave you this legal analysis, but that's not the way to go for Arizona or for the country generally.
Thanks very much. I'm pleased to be here. Pleased to welcome all of you also on behalf of the Immigration Law Program, which has been involved in putting this together. We encourage you also to take part in our future events, which will be further publicized. The federal government did challenge many of the provisions, most of the provisions of the Arizona law, but not quite all of them. So it wasn't a blanket challenge. The government sought a preliminary injunction only against a limited subset after a very careful consideration of where was it really needed, where you could make the claim about irreparable injury. The judge granted most of those. The Ninth Circuit affirmed that. Did not grant a preliminary injunction on some of them, but the government has preserved its arguments that those are still unconstitutional and will pursue those in other settings. I will also then focus on the four sections that Mr. Shapiro mentioned. But I want to start by really reflecting on this idea of preemption by executive whim. But I think that's quite dismissive of the way in which the government framed the arguments, and really does not sufficiently appreciate the array of policies, objectives, and purposes, the complex array of policies, objectives, and purposes that are in our immigration laws. Not in the executive's ideas about it, the executive's whims about it, but in the immigration laws and statutes themselves. Think about it in this way. There are many tens of millions of people, of foreigners, who enter this country every year, including about 1 million who come for lawful permanent residence. This movement across our borders is very important to us in a lot of ways. It's a big part of our tourism industry. Many people move for business purposes. If we didn't have a welcoming system for allowing that kind of movement, it would really impair international business, sports, entertainment. It would impair the cultural richness of this country. It's been important to colleges, both for the additional richness that foreign students can provide here and also, frankly, for monetary purposes as well. There may be some people here today who are providing UVA with that kind of richness in both senses. We appreciate it. It is a major part of the statutes of this country, appropriations laws as well as the Immigration and Nationality Act, to facilitate and to make welcome those people who come here legally from other countries. This is not an executive whim. It is firmly grounded in the statute. There are hundreds of pages of the Immigration and Nationality Act that deal with admission, the terms of admission. There are appropriations that go strongly toward facilitating the travel of others and making them feel more welcome. This was a particular step that was taken a few years after 9/11. We appropriately tightened up the screening and security mechanisms after 9/11, but it then became apparent that this was having the unintended consequence of making lots of people feel unwelcome. Businessmen changing their plans, businesses locating in different locations, students feeling deterred. They might ultimately have qualified, but they felt hassled and intimidated and deterred by some of the procedures that we had. So a lot more money was provided to speed up those processes and to be able to complete the screening in an appropriate way while still preserving those security concerns. So there are a wide array of statutory provisions that talk about facilitation and welcome, that promote immigration to this country. There's also a very important body of law, of course, that talks about complex objectives of enforcement as well. So somehow those have to be put into play, to carry it into execution, both of them. And Congress intends executive officers to balance those objectives equally. It intends federal executive officers to do so. I could give another example just within the context of federal law and federal enforcement. This is not, so it's not whim, it's clearly what Congress has intended. The Section 287 of the Immigration and Nationality Act gives power to immigration officers, quote, to interrogate without warrant any person believed to be an alien as to his right to be or to remain in the United States. Now, if that authority were exercised to its maximum, to the fullest extent of what that single provision seems to allow, especially in tourist meccas like New York or L.A. or Washington or the Grand Canyon, you can imagine that it would have a significant negative impact on this other set of objectives, or to do it in business centers like Wall Street or Michigan Avenue or the San Francisco Financial District would have a significant impact on other on our business, on our involvement in the global economy. So federal immigration agencies necessarily have to make decisions all the time about doing that balancing. They try to develop ways to be strategic, to maximize the enforcement impact against high-priority violators, and to, at the same time, to minimize any message of hassle or unwelcoming attitude that would be addressed to others. Further, those enforcement and facilitation decisions can have a direct and immediate impact on foreign relations. There's a long history of dealing with this. Maybe the first preemption case, Chai Lung versus in the immigration arena, Chai Lung versus Freeman in 1875, relied heavily on the possible impact on foreign nations if a state officer performed certain kinds of enforcement functions in ways that gave offense to other powerful nations. This is not a heckler's veto. This is a key element of understanding the structure of foreign relations. So now, to move with that from that to the Arizona law, which did provoke considerable response from foreign governments, but more importantly, I think the support for the Arizona law is premised on a simplistic notion that the federal immigration laws point only in one direction, that the objectives of the federal immigration law are only enforcement, and if only we had more resources or more officers to apply to it, we could achieve those objectives more completely. So in that context, why not welcome Arizona offering to do a lot more additional enforcement? But that's just simply not the case, not the federal statutory structure we have, not the array of federal policies that we have. There are many other cases where the Supreme Court has recognized this sort of more complex set of objectives, even when it would initially seem that the state is simply trying to boost the effort to achieve a federal objective. Example, the Crosby case. It dealt with the Massachusetts Burma law. The federal government had denounced the Burmese regime. The federal government had adopted a set of sanctions that were meant to bring pressure on the Burmese regime. Massachusetts adopted a stronger provision that said, we're not going to do business as a state with any company that does business with Burma. The Supreme Court noted the seeming similarity of objectives, but struck that down because it did not allow for the complex and effective way of trying to accomplish the federal government's goals as they had been set out by Congress. They were objectives that had many different facets. Other cases could be cited. I won't go into it. There's a case called Wisconsin Department versus Gould, and another one called Buckman Company versus Plaintiffs Legal Committee. They all were situations in which the state seemed to be acting in concert with the objectives of federal law. The Supreme Court said, no, this overly complicates things. The federal government needs to be able to decide on the right mix and the right strength of enforcement measures. These kinds of approaches don't necessarily mean that the state is unable to assist in federal enforcement. The federal government actually welcomes state involvement in federal enforcement, but in very specific ways that have been established by statute or by ongoing practice. And the federal government was careful to argue the Arizona case with that in mind, that cooperation is appropriate, but it has to be done in a way that's harmonious with federal objectives and that follows the federal government's lead. So I'm not defending the ruling finding these provisions of the Arizona law to be preempted on the basis that some immigration advocacy groups have seemed to argue for and have seemed to want, that is, a claim that immigration is exclusively federal with no role whatever for the states. That's not the legal situation that we have for either the executive or Congress. Cooperation is welcome, and there are some specific statutes that do assign specific authorities in careful ways to state government officials to help out in enforcement. So how would that apply to SB 1070? With regard to Article 3, I think it's fairly easy. That's the complete and carry provision that essentially said there will be state law punishments if you haven't done what you're supposed to do under the federal registration scheme. Hines versus Davidowitz, I think, is very much on point. If you read it in combination with Crosby and Gould and Buckman, yes, the state doesn't have its own registration requirements, but it says we're going to decide when we're going to apply criminal sanctions to those who don't cooperate. There is a federal scheme for federal sanctions. And on that particular provision, all the judges in the Ninth Circuit, including Judge Bea, were in agreement. Article 5C, I would agree with Mr. Shapiro that that's the one that criminalizes certain actions by employees who would work without status. I do believe that's preempted by the comprehensive federal scheme. Article 6, that's the authority to arrest without warrant if the person's committed a public offense that makes them removable. This, I think, is the strongest argument for the invalidity there is that it conflicts with another federal statute where Congress had made specific provisions to say that state officers may arrest in certain circumstances. They said they may arrest in a case where the individual has committed a felony in the past and was deported after that felony. And they may do that, though, only after they check with the federal government on the status. A very specific assignment of this kind of arrest authority under federal law, I think that implies that it precludes others. Now, there's some complications with an OLC opinion, which I also, a 2002 OLC opinion, which I also think is wrong, but I can say that now as a much more readily as a faculty member than as a federal government official, because that OLC opinion has not been revisited or overruled. And then Article 2, which has been the main arena, involving inquiring into the status for anyone stopped, arrested, or detained, there is a separate provision that mandates a verification of the person's immigration status, anyone who is arrested. So it's not the full category of those who are stopped. But anyone who is arrested, there's a mandate for a requirement that their status be verified before they are released. That, too, conflicts in the way that it provides, particularly that latter provision, provides for steps that are done not in cooperation with the federal government and that could go far beyond what the federal government has decided in the way of mixing the objectives of facilitation and enforcement. The final question here is really, well, so let me say, I think that these are both bad policy and preempted by federal law. What can states do about illegal aliens? That's the second part of our charge here. We can talk more about that in the question and answer period. But I think the main things that they can do and should do would be to exercise those powers that are specifically granted under the federal statutes. They can seek to enter into a 287G agreement. Those are controversial in their own right, but they do provide for extensive training by the federal government, monitoring and supervision by the federal government as well. And then beyond that, I think the main thing to do is to focus their cooperation of state and local officials on the criminal justice system. Do their arrests for state law offenses as they do otherwise, but work out cooperative arrangements to help identify people there and work with the federal government, respond to the federal government if they decide then to take some enforcement action in that setting. There's a new, fairly new program called Secure Communities. It too has been controversial, as is everything in this field, but that's a good mechanism and a good way to focus the involvement of state officers in immigration enforcement. Thank you.
So that's pretty much what you'd expect to hear from a federal official. I mean, he's a faculty member now, but very much, you know, reflect, with the exception of the little jibe at the OLC opinion, is pretty much, you know, reflective of someone trying to enforce federal law in a very difficult area. But ultimately, this comes down to the problem with the very first thing that Professor Mark started with, the purposes and objectives of the legislation, of what Congress did. Because, yeah, there are pages and pages of all this stuff, but it's internally contradictory and contrapurposive. If you look at what our immigration non-system does, right, you couldn't put together a more inefficient, incomprehensive, mutually exclusive at times set of regulations that have developed as a kind of by historical accident because of various, you know, interest group lobbying and so forth. Look, I'm an immigrant. I'm an immigrant twice over. I was born in Russia. When we came over, we took a wrong turn to the St. Lawrence Seaway, so I'm a naturalized Canadian. I finally got my green card 2 years ago. I mean, our policy just serves nobody, not the rich, not the poor, not big business, not small, not the educated, not the uneducated, not skilled immigrants or unskilled. I mean, it's you know, other than, I guess, immigration lawyers and bureaucrats, there's nobody who benefits from our immigration non-policy and this law that's convoluted and contradictory and leads us to the Supreme Court trying to decide what the heck's going on here. But at base, this is about what is immigration law, because federal government does have plenary power over immigration law, versus what is state police powers over housing, education, crime, business regulation, all of these different things. Because that's where the rub is. Provision X, be it SB 1070, be it Arizona's law, be it Utah trying to create its own guest worker program, going the other way, doing, you know, sanctuary cities, going the other way. It's not just states trying to be more, you know, restrictive or enforceive or what have you. Is that an actual regulation of immigration, which presumably is preempted because the federal government is supposed to be dealing with that? Or is it a regulation of something that's properly left to the states? And state law enforcement has been dealing with and arresting and handing over illegal aliens for decades. This is not something that started with Joe Arpaio in Arizona or SB 1070. you know, Rhode Island, so many different places have put in the local and state law enforcement agencies, with or without memorandums of understanding under 287G, have been doing this sort of thing. And again, the key is that it's not the state and local officials that make the determination about whether somebody's deportable or illegal or any of that. That determination is always referred to the proper federal officials who are charged with making them. And as long as that's the case, I don't have a problem with it. So this isn't about a patchwork of 50 immigration laws, again, but about state police power. And cooperation between local, state, and federal officials, is law enforcement is fine. Secured communities is fine. But, you know, there is leeway for states to put in some of these sorts of regulations.
Well, I'm not going to try to argue that the immigration system is the most efficient, most effective overall scheme. But I do want to make a case, just to put it a little bit in perspective. There's a lot of areas where we have enormous controversy and enormous disappointments. There are real problems in the system. But this is a really massive system, and the parts that work we often overlook. We do, in fact, carry out a lot of commerce and dealings, movements of people with the rest of the world. There are 400 million people who are admitted to the United States, who go through our border processing and are admitted. Many of those are citizens. Many of those are repeat crossers. This is a vast system. People do get here. We do have students who are here. Mr. Shapiro did get his green card. We have...
By going to Iraq and getting a letter from General Petraeus to help me get certified and so forth.
Sometimes you have to pull threads. Did the ethics officer pass on that? Did General Petraeus?
Not on letterhead, as is in his personal capacity.
I think a lot of those problems go back to the fact that, in fact, as a society, we're quite ambivalent on what we want. We tend to pride ourselves as being a country of immigration, also a country of laws. I've had many experiences in my government, in my time in government and elsewhere, where people would make very broad statements, members of Congress, about how we've got to crack down, we've got to be much more rigorous about enforcing the laws, and then come back and I get a call, well, can't you do something about this nice Salvadoran family? They're really hard workers. Why aren't you going after the real criminals? I think that reflects an impulse that's in a lot of us, and that's really why we're so gridlocked. And we are gridlocked, totally gridlocked, on the federal electoral scene with regard to doing that. But I think in that setting, it is far better if we settle this as a nation at the federal level. It's going to be very difficult to do it, but we're much more likely to come out with an overall effective policy that sustains both of those traditions as a nation of laws and as a nation of immigrants if we do that, not as 50 separate units, but as one coherent federal system. Thank you.